Hello, welcome to The Poison Pen. I'm Barbara Peters, and with us this evening is debut novelist. I say debut novelist because she's actually written some books. Francesca Saritella. Hi, Francesca.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Now, you will notice, I'm going to do the commercial part of this thing first, that we have absolutely no copies of Ghosts of Harvard here. And the reason is that Francesca has them and is sending them to us. I will also add that we have almost no signed copies left unsold. So if you are interested in one watching this talk, I advise you to order as quickly as you can. So that's really good news, isn't it? You didn't waste any energy signing books for no purpose.
Oh, I was thrilled and so happy. And they're already on their way to you, so they should be there in no time.
Great. But I do see behind you a copy of Ghost of Harvard right over there by the roses,
behind
right?
Me with
oh, there's one.
I'm
excellent.
Loudly with them. Yeah.
Well, we aren't, as it all turns out. So let's talk about a little bit about you. You got into writing, doing these collections of essays with hilarious titles with your mom, Lisa Scottolini. I looked it up today, and my personal favorite is, Does This Beach Make Me Look Fat?
That was a fun title. I remember I thought of that and when we were driving around in the car. For some reason, we always did our best thinking in the car together. And we were like, is that too silly to use? No, just silly enough.
Well, that was a question I was going to ask you, is that how did you come up with the titles? Because sometimes, you know, publishers do it, but I sort of felt like you and your mom probably titled most of these books.
Oh, sure. Gosh, no, we would have epic brainstorming sessions and come up with 100 really just jokes that fell flat. And then, you know, you have to come up with 100 jokes that don't work to come up with one that makes you smile. And it was always sort of a fun and ridiculous exercise, but we always did it ourselves.
So for you, how was the transition from writing essays and collaborating with your mom to being a sole novelist? Was it scary?
I mean, it was, you know, it's a funny thing. I think the adjustment felt more stark on the reader side because, of course, I was working on this novel all along. I have really been working on this book for, you know, basically 10 years. So I was concurrently doing both. So I sort of always had this divided mind and always had this long-held dream to write a novel of my own. But really, I'm just so grateful to our readers of the essay collections because this dream would not have been possible without all of their support, your support, Barbara, and everything. So it was really, I've enjoyed doing both. They were both so different, but to me, it didn't feel like a big shift.
Now, being a writer isn't necessarily a calling you're born with. Was there some, you know, because your mom has been so successful, although your mom will tell you that she and I first met at a time when she was not quite so successful.
Right.
The very start of her career in a bathroom in a New York hotel where she was up for an award, which I think she lost to Dana Stabenow. We often talk about that. It was a paperback. Do you remember Everywhere That Mary Went?
It was probably the first Edgar Awards. And I
Absolutely.
Think she did, it was the first time she was nominated, although I think she was nominated with her very first book, which is impressive. But then she did win it the second time around. But no, what you get at is so true. And I don't know if I believe so much in any genetic connection or something like that. But I do think what you're getting at is saying that you remember her building this long career. I always say that I was very lucky to have been born not to a best-selling author, but to a beginning one. And I watched her build her career brick by brick. And what I saw at home wasn't her splashy success. It was her work ethic, her perseverance, everything. And that really was so inspiring to me. And I think even though she has reached such superstar status now, it was why it wasn't just too intimidating because the whole process had been demystified. And I saw it as the work and the passion for the work, not the passion for the results.
You know, I'm an historian. And if I go back to like the Middle Ages, you can see that trades run in families. You know, you would have a goldsmith and he would train his son to be a goldsmith and on.
Right.
You know, doctors often have children that turn out to be physicians in some form or other, or lawyers and so forth. And, you know, there are quite a few writers who have children that write, and then there have other writers whose children flee in horror at the very prospect, you know, of having a writing career. So I don't know, you know, is the pressure inside you or is it just something because you're, you know, it's an everyday thing at your house, is just something that you naturally wandered into? Do you remember?
I mean, I do, because what I remember is I never had any pressure. I never had any pressure to follow in her footsteps. It wasn't as if writing is the only profession that my mother admires. So it wasn't like that. It didn't, and truthfully, I didn't know from the start that I always would. She really encouraged me to explore other interests. If you read this book, you'll get the idea that you see my interests vary. You know, I are widespread. I love the sciences. I love all different kinds of things. But I do think that I had this incredible example, living example. And I think, sadly, a lot of creative professions are very mysterious. And in some ways, various privileges have kept them that way. And where it's only certain people can be an author, and it's very unclear how a book gets on the shelf and what's that process. So I think having it demystified was a huge blessing and advantage to just really conceiving of what this profession is like. And then when I ended up really enjoying it, and I tried to be different, I tried other things, but I just really realized that the passion was in with me too. Then I had even the most supportive parent of all to understand that, she wasn't holding out for law school.
Right. My daughter, the lawyer, right? That whole thing. So it's called The Ghosts of Harvard. And the reason it's Harvard rather than, say, Stanford or something is because you yourself went to Harvard, right?
I did. I longed to go to Stanford, but I chickened out with the distance from being so far from home as a little East Coaster that I am. But yes, I went to Harvard, and sadly, a sad memory from my time there is part of what inspired this book.
And what was that?
When I was a junior, a young man in my upperclassman dorm took his own life. And he wasn't a close friend, but he was someone I was used to seeing in the dining hall, who I never would have suspected was suffering with any kind of illness. You know, that's the tragedy of mental illness, is that even in acute moments of crisis, it can be completely invisible to other people and to a community. And, we were all shocked and saddened. But I felt like at the time, as a community and my classmates, we didn't really know how to talk to each other about it. And I don't think we did a good job of comforting one another. We just sort of compartmentalized. And then a year later, I remember I was reading an article about his little sister had learned to play guitar in that year's time because he was a musician. And she came to Harvard's campus to play a tribute to him on the anniversary of his death. And I was just knocked back in my chair reading that, because I thought, wow, what was that year like for her? And that suicide is a complicated loss, and it's a complicated grief. And like I said, I really think we still lack sort of insufficient vocabulary and understanding for how to comfort one another. So we build walls, we keep those walls up. But for a family, that's not an option. A tragedy like that happens, doesn't just happen to one person in a family, it happens to the whole unit. And the book is not in any way based on that particular family or that particular story, but I was really inspired by that sister's love and her commitment and her courage. And I just never forgot that. So when I was, that ended up becoming the jumping off point for this entirely fictional novel.
Dealing in the aftermath of suicide is so terrible. When I was an undergraduate at Stanford, because in point of fact, when I had to choose colleges, Harvard didn't accept women. So, there was a young man in one of the fraternities who went to a party and got really wasted, and sat down in the driveway leading up to the fraternity house, and somebody ran him over and killed him. Ugh. And, it was a terrible event and a stupid event, but it wasn't a conscious act. And so you didn't have that residue of, guilt sure you did in the sense of, somebody should have walked him up to the door and those kinds of things. But it was easier to talk about it under those conditions, then I can imagine that it would have been to talk about the young man who took his own life from what, as you say, is an invisible illness.
Exactly. I mean, I think that is where the source of the discomfort comes from, talking about suicide. I think after writing this novel and researching it so much, I would suggest that these two tragedies that we just raised the examples are not as different as we might think. I think it's really not fair and maybe not accurate to put a rational thinking framework on suicide. It is a symptom of mental illness. It's a terminal one. It's a mistake, but it is not a rational choice in the way that we talk about other. I used to, before I wrote this book, you know, you hear suicide, oh, it's a selfish act. How can you do that to your family? After researching it, I couldn't think, I completely changed my thinking about that. And I think that's coming from putting a healthy mindset and a rational mindset on that act. And it's very hard to empathize with, because we can't empathize with being in that kind of acute pain and being in that kind of acute illness. But I think it's important that we, you know, really see it and make sure that we don't define the people we lose that way by their final moment and by which is a disease.
It is a disease. And, you know, the other thing that very much struck me when reading your book is that this young man, Eric, the brother of Katie, the girl that goes to Harvard and pursues the question of what happened to him and how her family and how she can come to terms with it, was on the genius line. I mean, it was obviously very right. gifted, very interested in physics and so forth. And then, like, unfortunately, a lot of young men in particular, although young women can do it, fell prey to schizophrenia, which seems to happen at the top of the teenage years. It's a very vulnerable time, and there must be some genetic or other component that causes it to go haywire. And I don't know that there's any way to say that it's linked to intelligence or
no, but you're whatever. Absolutely right. It is correlated. It's not able to say that it's caused, but schizophrenia has a higher incidence in genius IQ. Right. And I learned that, and that really started making me think about, you know, what is a more highly sensitive brain? What is a more finely tuned brain? Is it more vulnerable as well? You know, from this super strength might also come a vulnerability. And I think, you know, suicide is something that young people is a tragedy that affects young people across the board at every college. What I think happens at colleges like Harvard or really any school, but is that it's quick to dismiss, well, those kids must all be doing great because they're high achievers and they can handle things. But you know what? They're still young people with, you know, their own still maturing minds, still maturing coping mechanisms, and any kind of, you know, depression and mental health on college campus is really important. And it's we have to be careful not to write those kids off as that they can all, you know, that any kid going to college must be doing so well, whereas they might be doing so well and need help.
Good point. I would like to turn to our audience and say that we've had this discussion because it's the background for the story. This is not a self-help or medical text or
you're right.
Or a memoir. It's in fact a really interesting mystery, but you have to know the background of why Katie goes to Harvard, why she has to deal with her family who are quite opposed to it, and then what happens to her when she gets there and tries to figure out if maybe there was something more to her brother's suicide than appears. So I really love, there's a lot of things to talk about. We've already talked about schizophrenia and suicide. I'm checking off my list here. So talk to me a little bit, because Eric was studying physics and he was particularly engaged in entanglement theory. So what in the world is entanglement theory?
Entanglement theory is a theory of quantum physics about how two separate particles can influence one another and how even in influencing their spin. And what I really, the way I use that, you do not need to understand physics or be any kind of expert to enjoy this novel. I'm not an expert. And really I use it more metaphorically in the sense that this story is told from a sister's perspective. It's told from Katie Archer's perspective as she's struggling with this grief and with this loss and with all those unanswered questions that haunt her about what happened at Harvard. And she really, you know, I think she has defined herself relationally to her brother. They are entangled. They have influenced each other's spins their entire lives long. And I think that's something that we can all relate to in a family. You know, you sort of get assigned roles. Sometimes those roles are really helpful emotional, you know, scaffolding in a sense to build your own identity. And sometimes they can be confining and not always fit. And what happens in this family is for Katie's entire life, her older brother was the golden child and she was the second banana, and she was comfortable in that supportive role. She was comfortable with that dynamic. And then when he gets sick and starts to pull away from her and behave in ways she can't understand, and then when he makes this unfathomable choice to take his own life, it really not only impacts her of the loss, but it impacts how she sees herself. Who is she if she's not Eric Archer's little sister, or if that meaning has now drastically changed? And I think this book is as much of a journey of seeking closure and understanding of her brother as it's really seeking understanding about herself and finding who is she if she's not defined in relation to him.
That is very well said. Now, in addition to all of that, there is actually a sort of detective or at least investigative plot. Talk to me a little bit about is it Cashing or Cashing? I'm not even sure how to pronounce it.
Cashing, I think.
Okay. So geocaching. What happens is that she does find a notebook, right? Or is it more than one?
Just one. She has sort of taken with her to her own journey of campus, on campus, Eric's old physics lab notebook, which is a lot of scribblings that she's not sure she can understand. And then she sort of tries to retrace his steps emotionally and literally, while of course she's grappling with her own mental health challenges, maybe, while trying to follow those steps. But yes, she does begin to believe that there's some kind of mapping element. I don't want to spoil too much, but.
No, we don't want to. But yeah. I think geocaching I've run across it in real life. There's a guy in Santa Fe where we live part-time who owned an art gallery and went out, I'm not sure if it's apocryphal or real, but I tend to think it's real, and buried this treasure out somewhere in the New Mexico desert. And people have been trying to, find it using clues and whatever for absolutely forever. So it's a real thing that people can do for various reasons. But in this case, you use it as sort of an investigative map, which I thought was a very interesting thing to introduce into the story.
Yes. I think there's many plot lines in this book, but the two dual tracks are both her trying to retrace and suss out and investigate the mystery of Eric's final year and see what exactly he was going through in addition to his legitimate, genuine mental illness. And then at the same time, she has this inward threat of what her own mind is doing to her, because of course she begins to hear voices herself. And we're all reading that Hidden Valley book about the genetic component of schizophrenia. And she first fears, does she share her brother's mental illness? Or could these voices be something else? She begins to believe there's something else, and we are not exactly sure if we should believe her too.
Pause one moment. Hidden Valley. Patrick, is this your Panda Witch book? No? Different book? What is the Hidden Valley book you mentioned?
Maybe I hope I didn't misremember the title. It was recently chosen for the Oprah book, and it's book club pick, and it's about a single family who had an incidence of six family members who all have schizophrenia, and it's a nonfiction about how they became so helpful. I'm just trying to break.
No, you didn't misremember it. There is, what was the Panowicz's book? Hard Cash Valley. Sorry, Patrick is very enamored of a book called Hard Cash Valley, in which, if I remember right, there is a brother that, isn't there some sort of something like that in the book? Maybe I'm just confusing it. The book you're talking about.
Even read it. It was just serendipitous that the two books came out around the same time and that both happened to deal with this genetic, predisposition, the way that a genetic predisposition to schizophrenia is shared. But if you enjoyed that book, I think you would enjoy the fictionalization of that very concern.
I think you're absolutely right. And I do remember, I haven't read the book, but I think there's six children in this family who all display some sorts of schizophrenia, which again sort of highlights the genetic component, because it can't be completely random that six people would,
this book is very much about that duality of potential, the excellence of potential and college students who have their whole lives ahead of them and all this bright future. But it's also about the pressure of those future expectations. And then even in this case, we have positive potential to achieve success. And then you also have potential maybe to repeat patterns in your family or to play out, you know, stories and myths and you know, that potential of a latent mental illness.
So if there are ghosts, and I'm leaving that as a big if, are there three ghosts? And that's almost Dickensian, isn't it? The ghosts of Christmas, past, present, and future. Why is it that we tend to think in triads rather than like two or four?
That's a good question. I don't know, although I'll tell you, I mean, I can speak to the Dickens, and my dog Pip, named after Great Expectations, is sleeping right beside me. Yes, you know, I love A Christmas Carol, I'm blank for a moment. I love that so much. And I really love the good old Gothic fiction where there were just ghost characters that weren't necessarily used as jump scare moments or horror, you know, traditional horror genre. But really, I think we're always fascinated with the way that ghosts are reflections of our psyche. You know, I think that's why psychological suspense and the supernatural elements of this book blended so easily for me, because I really think that there is that nature in our interest in ghosts already. It's always sort of an interest in ourselves. What are the stories and that haunt us? What are the types of things that, you know, we haunt? In this book, I have a line to something like, you know, ghosts don't haunt the living, we haunt them, you know, and I think that's really true. We want to know from them. We want to get messages from the other side more than the other side is trying to reach out to us sometimes.
Or it can simply be our subconscious speaking to us such a way that we might think of it as the ghost when it actually isn't. I mean, certainly in A Christmas Carol, you know, are they really Jacob Marley back, or, you know, is this something else?
Right. Although there is one difference that I always point out is that, it's so funny you mentioned Christmas Carol, because in so many interviews I've said, you know, these ghosts aren't the type who come rattling chains. What's different with these ghosts is that, one, they're only voices, they're potentially only auditory hallucinations, but, or maybe echoes from another time, but they don't know they're dead. So they come to her, and I have this funky, spooky physics explanation of how they work, but really as time folded over, you know, we speak and think about time in a linear way, but quantum physicists around the world will agree that there are many dimensions in which we cannot perceive, and where time and space-time is compactified and folded over and reversed. And I was really, just that lit up my imagination. And so I thought of this version where these voices from the past are coming to her, not with any, you know, future or retrospective knowledge, but she meets these three people at the turning points in their lives, and it mimics the way she fears that she missed the turning point to save her brother.
Let's talk a little bit about names. You have some very interesting names in her. I think Mikaela Prokop was a fascinating name. So, you know, how did you choose them?
You know what? You're talking to a Francesca. So I have a soft spot for people with unusual names, but traditional, but unusual. And certainly when I was at Harvard, what really struck me was incredibly diverse student body, the diverse faculty. So I tried to really think authentically of just reflecting my experience. And it's, you know, I just explored. Believe me, I encountered a lot of unusual names there, and it was really enriching. But so I got to have fun with these character names.
I can see that you would, and it does add a lot of personality, you know, to a novel when everybody isn't named Jack or Betty or something like that. One of the things I enjoyed the most about, and I think people who are drawn to the whole campus is a background, you know, in a way, Harvard functions kind of like an Agatha Christie country house here. I mean,
exactly.
It's contained, and there are a number of very memorable books that have used schools or campus, you know, Donna Tartt, whatever.
Yes, I love that book.
As a background, but certainly an advantage to them is the closed nature of it, so you don't have to deal with the whole universe. But I really enjoyed the way you talked about campus life, and of course your campus life and my campus life are two generations or three probably apart, so it was a revelation. Did you just bring in your own experience into the book, as one probably would?
It was a combination of my own experience and memories, of course, but also I did do more research, subsequent research, to stay fresh and to notice the things that I overlooked when I was just an undergrad, you know. But I'll tell you, even as a student, one thing that's clear about that school is that Harvard is a character the moment you set foot on campus. It's a school that is obsessed with its own history, obsessed with its weighty legacy. It really lays it on these 19-year-old and 20-year-old shoulders pretty heavily. And then by the same token, it's a normal college like anywhere else where people are drinking out of red Solo cups and trying to catch the eye of the cute person in their section and sleeping through their 9 a.m. classes. So it has this uneasy, or at least interesting, maybe it's interesting that it's not uneasy, you know, juxtaposition of life and youth and forward thinking and fun, and then also this weighty history. You know, it was founded in 1636. It predates our nation. And so many of the buildings are these living memorials. I mean, around every corner, there's a reminder of somebody important who died. And, you know, the Widener Library is Widener, who went down on the Titanic, and there's a colonial cemetery. You know, everything in this book, I didn't fictionalize a single tombstone or a single plaque. There really is a tombstone that has the small epitaph, "Young friends, prepare for sudden death," a stone's throw from Harvard Yard, where everybody is young and, you know, expecting this great long future. So, and of course, the daunting reminder is that the only path to immortality is success. And I think that's, it's just an incredibly, it's a pressure cooker for that reason. It's a hard place to feel free and live in the moment when you have this weighty past weighing on you and the expectations of the future, you know, oh, you think you're good at computer science? Are you the next Mark Zuckerberg? Because if you're not, like, they're not impressed, you know? And it's just, it's like, it's tough. I think that's why for some people, what should be a launch pad feels like a precipice.
That's a really good phrase. And I was thinking as you said that, when I went to Stanford, which is 1958, it was really just digging into inventing itself and acquiring a history and the weight of prestige and expectation. In fact, it was referred to as the Harvard of the West, but it wasn't there yet. And they had a very active program poaching professors and students and so forth from back east. So we were in a different place. There was a lot of expectation, but we were all like forging something for the future. Whereas you say, and I can certainly imagine it, that Harvard had this weight of the past. So it's a very different, you know, very different experience. And that's why choosing a college is so important.
Yes, I think, I mean, I so sympathize with the way that the pressure that gets put on juniors in high school, like that to choose the college that they're going to get into in these tests as if it is determinative of future, like it's the most, your fate's going to be sealed. Everything is for when you're a teenager feels so consequential. And I think this book both reflects that feeling, that authentic feeling, but in, I hope, pokes holes in it, because I think we overestimate our potential to determine outcomes. And this book really deals with a lot of unintended consequences and the way that you're never going to be able to exert perfect control over your future. You're certainly not going to be able to control somebody else's future. And the best you can do is to live in the as close to the moment as possible and learn from your mistakes.
I think it's a very brave book and certainly a very complicated book. You've set yourself a very high bar in terms of ingredients, and I'm going to assume that you are already thinking about a new book, because writers write, you know. Right. I don't think of you as a one book author.
No, that's so kind of you to say. Thank you. I certainly hope not, and I'm planning to have a long and happy career, because this is just my dream job, and I'm so honored and grateful that I get to do it. I am working on a next novel already. It is not a sequel to Ghosts of Harvard, but I think if you enjoy the genre bending of this book and the same elements and big questions, I think you'll enjoy it too. Feels a little too soon to talk about it. It's still in that fragile early draft stage, but I'm excited about it.
Well, that's great. As long as you're excited about it, readers should right. be excited. Let me ask Patrick, do we have anything that, Patrick has a couple of questions he's going to wander over here and just pitch at you.
Hey, Francesca. I've had a couple of viewers here who are asking about the choral, the choir parts of the book and how much
goes,
and just asking, you know, assuming that that's a very important part of your life as well.
You're exactly right. I was a big super, for at the time, what felt a serious singer. And I was in Collegium, which is the choir that's in featured in this book, because of course I couldn't figure out how to fictionalize that. So I, like Katie, was a second soprano in the choir, and we even sang that Abendlied song, which is in this novel, which I found so soothing and a little bit eerie. So I wanted to put it in the book. You know, something I was reading in my research was that physics and music have always gone hand in hand. And I didn't necessarily think about that. I really struggled in physics, but I know what they mean. And I so enjoyed music as an element in this story. I have a scene with the church organ in Memorial Church on Harvard's campus, which I always feel, I feel that music is very spiritual. I guess that's all, what I'll say, you know, especially choral music. It's just, you feel like you're getting to some different plane sometimes. And also that you feel that you're getting to a different plane outside of yourself. It's something where I also love, like I love musical theater, but I always come back to being a choir nerd a little bit, because as much as it's great to be belting that big solo moment and have, you know, all eyes on you on a stage, that's fun. But there's some different pleasure and a different, like, hair on the back of your neck tingle in a good way when you can get four voices together, perfectly blending, perfectly harmonizing. The sum is greater. What is it? The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. You know, it's, you achieve something completely different in that sweet spot of harmony. And I remember learning there's reference in this book to the overtones, where it's like an extra tone that becomes this ethereal, ghostly extra tone that is created when voices are perfectly harmonized and right in pitch. And it's that sound of like a crystal glass. When you put water on it, it makes a woo, you know, it's like you can hear this extra tone. And I just was really interested in that. And I made the one thing I don't share with the main character, I mean, many things I don't share with the main character, but as far as singing, is she has perfect pitch. I don't think I have perfect pitch. I have pretty good pitch, but I don't even play an instrument. I learned to read music, but singing was the only thing. But perfect pitch is like the incredibly rare ability to see a tone with as much instant recognition as you see color. When we see red, you go, that's red. I know it. I don't need to reference it. I don't need to see another image of red and compare it. You know that color is red. Some people have that ability with music and tone, and that they could just hear a note and nail it, and or they can hear a note and hear that it's a little bit flat or a little bit sharp. And I think similar to the way we're talking about, is a genius more prone to a mental illness like schizophrenia? I was really intrigued with this idea of that this main character has a finely tuned, you know, preternaturally tuned ear, and then begins hearing things. And, you know, is she just losing it, or is she just hearing something that other people can't hear? Are we perceiving something in a different dimension that other people can't share?
I was thinking about that because I used to sing as well, but never had perfect pitch. But what I do know is that there are certain physical configurations that make some people amazing singers. And other people who would like to don't have the, I remember Helen Trouble, who was the famous Wagnerian soprano at the Metropolitan Opera, and somebody described her body as like a perfect bellows. She had
right,
enormous yeah. lung capacity and so forth, and she could stand and she could, you know, summon it up and push out that air and achieve a sound that was amazing. And that's physiology in part. And it may be right. that perfect pitch is in fact related to that, you know, some people's ear structures, you know, their hearing structures.
Right.
I mean, there are people who can, for example, draw a perfect circle. So right. what is it that allows them to do that?
Right. And where is that balance of like learned craft and skill versus just innate ability? And yeah, it's remarkable.
I was just thinking that takes you back to Amadeus and the way that the man who wrote, I'm trying to remember, Peter, whatever his name is, tried to, you know, take Salieri and Mozart. And, you know, in the book, the thesis was that Mozart really was a gift from God, his musical. He's the first draft composer. We have his scores, and he really was incredibly a first draft. And Salieri, no matter how he... this is in the fictional version because we don't know how it really was. No matter how he tried, he did not have that same innate ability. But still, if you watch the movie, Mozart was a real mess away from composing. You know, he really was. So maybe there's a price to be paid for certain kinds of genius where it makes you less functional as a person in society, as a person in relationships and so forth.
It's, right. It's what is a gift and what is a curse? They used to call depression, and I mean, way back in the kind of unenlightened days, they used to call depression the affliction of, melancholia was the affliction of the intellectuals. It was like literally believed that the more learned or scholarly or, you know, intelligent you were, the more prone to melancholy you were. And I just think all that stuff's so interesting. I don't want to give too much credence to it because I think a lot of it's just kind of backwards thinking. I think, now we know more and know that these types of things don't discriminate. But at the same time, you wonder, you think about it, you talk about it.
Well, I don't think there's any question that as medical science is racing ahead, currently spurred on by desperate efforts to find a vaccine and understand the genetics of the virus, that the more we learn, the more some of these questions will become clearer. And, it may head us in some long distant future towards the kind of thing we've always rebelled against, which is some sort of genetic pre-programming for children and so forth. So if you want a child who's going to be musical, do this and whatever. I don't know. There's a lot of scary things, I think.
Yeah.
Lots of really good stuff for you to write about.
Exactly. I'm never one for material, right?
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Francesca. Patrick, anything else?
Yeah.
Whoop, hold on. Another question here.
Yeah, this is more of a comment. A viewer says, I love the perfect pitch references. It can be maddening at times. It was a great underlying reference for your character who is questioning their mental health. That's an interesting connection.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear it. Yeah, I have a few friends, because I was in choirs, I've got some musical friends, and so I have a few friends who have perfect pitch, and sometimes they'll complain about the funniest things. They'll be, like, when he or she, I don't know, the commenter says, it's maddening. I have one friend who's a guy who was like, ugh, it was so annoying because my microwave went off at the same time that, my phone text chime went off, and the two tones, they really clash. It's a C sharp and a B, like, he knows what notes they are and knows that they harmonize dissonantly, and it bugs him. And I can't even imagine, hearing the music of our surroundings to that degree, but it happens.
And then, let's see, I have another question. Are any of your characters based on people you know in real life? And if so, which characters?
My official answer is no. No, I mean, we're always inspired. I have a very snarky professor in this book who is really inspired by an even snarkier, meaner professor I really had. And also, there are wonderful, compassionate professors in this novel who are after wonderful and compassionate professors that I had. So, I ran the gamut with that. But Katie lives in almost every dorm that I lived in, took a lot of the classes similar to ones that I took. And the choir director, I actually based off of my high school choir director and even named it Mr. Sutcliffe. I made him Dr. Sutcliffe in this book because he deserves a PhD in being wonderful and a lovely, warm teacher. So I bumped him up. But mostly only at the teacher level, really.
Yeah, but it's hard as an author not to actually cannibalize people you know, even if you only take some particular trait or something about them, and use right. them to make a more vibrant character in your book. I mean,
I think every artist, you blend them, so it's really, it wouldn't be fair to say that it's, even the examples I just gave, that's that person. It isn't, but it is, blends, and it's like a little smoothie of a person of a lot of different ingredients, but of course of my experiences there.
Francesca, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I love meeting authors at the very outset of their career and then following them along. We've been here for, this is our 31st year, we've been able to track careers of many authors in real time because we've read them from their first novel on up. So it's lovely to have a chance to meet you at the outset of your career, and we'll look forward to tracking you as we move along.
It's the most lovely for me. I want to thank you. I'm so honored to be hosted by you this way, even virtually, and so grateful for the opportunity we're all learning these new methods with this pandemic book launch, but I'm just so grateful to be meeting your readers and your community this way. And I've never received, I said this to you in an email, but I've never received more messages from readers about this bookstore in particular. Oh my gosh, that's whenever I'm in Arizona, I always have to go there. And you have such a far-reaching affection for the, and your community goes far, much all the way to the East Coast and back. So thank you so much.
Well, it's really a pleasure. So say hi to your mom, and we'll talk to you again before too long. We'll plan on a little session to talk about the essays, because they are so much fun that we've never had a chance to do that. I want to thank, oh, you already quit. Okay, never mind. Patrick is done. Anyway, it's great, Francesca, and thanks. Congratulations on the wonderful reception for your book.
Thank you. I've been so gratified and really happy. This has just been a dream come true.
Well, great. All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. We'll have a wonderful night. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.